Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for May 5th, 2010. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast. In it, I have a monologue, as promised, considering the aspect of Doctor Who as a hacker. Also, I've got a new hacker word of the week. This term actually has been dropped from the most current version of the jargon file, but when you hear it, its etymology, then you'll understand why I included it. And if you're curious as to when it was actually dropped, and I think it mentions maybe the reasons in the chaff file, just follow the link to the word of the week in the show notes. First, though, I want to thank Silicon Dragon and Graham for their donations this past week. Especially Silicon Dragons was very, very generous, for which he earns a Command Line Nerd merit badge, and I'll send that out amongst the first batch when those arrive from the embroiderer, which should be within, I think, the next week or so. Also, before we get started, I wanted to give a quick review. I haven't done one in a while, and a book that I just recently finished. This is an older book. It's one that I took out from the library. You should still be able to find one in your local library as well. It's Carl Schrader's Permanence. This is his second book. It was printed in 2002, I think late in the year, and then there was a trade paperback edition, also unfortunately out of print, printed the next year. This is actually a wonderfully good book. It's the first book by Carl Schrader that I read. I would definitely classify it as part of the new genre, hard space opera, or the new space opera. It's the melding of hard science fiction with space opera. It definitely has that sort of grand adventure feel to it, a very large settings and spacescapes involved. It spans many multiple systems and what they refer to as these halo worlds. These are worlds in orbit around brown dwarfs, gas giants that are failed stars. It also explores some pretty interesting notions about history, culture, and biology along the way. For all that, it's intensely readable, highly enjoyable, and I would actually say that if you're looking for a family-friendly book to share, there isn't really anything in here. There are a couple of intense action scenes, but nothing that I think is overly violent or grotesque, and there are no mature scenes in other regards. So I myself have been on a kick of trying to find young adult science fiction suitable for sharing with my geeklings, and I think this is one that I may check out from the library again when they finish the backlog of stuff that I've already checked out. So go to your local library if you can, or if you have a friend who has a copy of Schrader's Permanence, I highly recommend it. Listener feedback this week comes from Robert, who posted a comment up on the website in response to my rant on the problems I have with NoSQL. And he wrote, just some feedback on ORM, that's Object Relational Mapping, versus NoSQL or NoSQL. I don't disagree with a lot of your argument in favor of relational database systems, but there are a few points that I have personally encountered that I would like to bring up. First, relational and ORM systems certainly provide a flexibility of use for data that NoSQL lacks. I think a lot of your point boils down to upfront design of the data space for an application. If you do this work diligently, there's a lot of flexibility that comes with it. However, having dealt with Google App Engine and porting applications, you get an intimate, detailed account of how your ORM interacts with a large NoSQL database in a way that you rarely see with relational database systems. ORM becomes, in the traditional sense, a layer of abstraction that you have to understand in order to effectively develop an app. With less structured or object-oriented databases, you understand it at a more fundamental level, and quote-unquote queries mean more what they mean in real-world costs than in an ORM system. Systems like GAE, which attach a real monetary cost to calls, disillusion a lot of programmers about not just what the trivial costs of their queries are, but what the mapping costs are in CPU time. Hibernate or TopLink are great for bootstrapping an application. Yes, you can tweak them for performance, but something like App Engine with its mapping of traditional ORM to a NoSQL system can expose performance problems the traditional developer might not see. Thank you for that, Robert. I'm actually reading O'Reilly's programming Google App Engine right now. There are a couple of small web applications that I want to build for some personal use and sharing, and I've gotten far enough along to get some sense of what it is that you're talking about. It seems that the data store that Google App Engine provides has either probably in the SDK, probably in the local environment that you run. I just read the section on indexes. Some instrumentation to get at what you're talking about in terms of primitive, if not much more sophisticated profiling of the data layer. That makes some sense. That's worth bearing in mind. Anybody else, of course, who's working with Google App Engine who can ring in and support or with some additional information for what Robert has to say, I'd appreciate that. And as always, I appreciate all of the listener feedback. Robert, that was a great comment. If you wish to send me your thoughts on anything I talk about on this show or I write up on the website, you can send that to feedback@thecommandline.net. The hacker word of the week comes from the jargon file maintained by Eric Raymond at catb.org. Block transfer computations. Noun. From the television series Doctor Who. Computations so fiendishly subtle and complex that they could not be performed by machines. Used to refer to any task that should be expressible as an algorithm in theory, but isn't. The Z80's LDIR instruction, computed block transfer with increment, may also be relevant. When I don't have enough bile for a rant, and can't muster the necessary peace and serenity for an inner chapter, all that's left is for me to express my evil genius side and do a monologue. My first introduction to Doctor Who, like many people my age in the US, was through American public television. I was definitely a child of Sesame Street and The Electric Company. Once I outgrew those shows, though, I thought of PBS as all classical music, opera, and fine drama, stuff that a young man really wouldn't be all that interested in. In other words, as an older kid, I equated it with younger programming or boredom. I think it was my brother who showed me my first episode of Doctor Who. Even before I saw enough to realize what was going on, I was struck. At that time, you could always spot the British programming on PBS. Here in the States, at that time, they used the same film for indoor and outdoor scenes. At the same time, the BBC was using two different film stocks. Interiors were always crisp and bright, while exterior shots were somehow muddy. I think Doctor Who may have been the first program where I saw this, so much so that when I saw the same difference in picture quality later, I always got a bit of a thrill wondering if I had stumbled on a Doctor Who episode. Given the strange settings and always new characters, it wasn't entirely unlikely that some initially mundane scene might give way to a papier-mâché monster. One of the advantages of watching it young was that the poor special effects didn't mar it for me. It was exotic, knowing it came from another country, too. The local station ran mostly Tom Baker episodes, many of which had a darker edge, sometimes an outright scary story. As an adult, enjoying the recent revival, I realized something. The Doctor is a hacker, but of time and space. Even from the earliest viewings, I appreciated the Doctor was a different sort of hero. Unlike Captain Kirk or Jim West from Wild Wild West, he wasn't violent, and he was very rarely physical. I mean, he ran around quite a bit in many incarnations, but that wasn't really the focus. He was a problem solver first, not a brawler. He had a vast store of knowledge to begin with, an encyclopedic collection of facts about the universe throughout time. If he didn't have all the facts, he knew enough to learn them before acting. Often he would befriend locals who could help him understand and then act. He was adept at using this information and local resources. Many of the stories contrived to rob him of the TARDIS or his sonic screwdriver or both to put that skill and native intelligence to the test. John Pertwee's Doctor, the Third Doctor, was entirely stuck on Earth. Though he still had some fine gadgets, most notably a car he had actually hacked to make it inertialess, and they used some, in retrospect, pretty cheesy camera tricks to pull that off. But the concept of it was appealing, and I think remains appealing to hackers and makers alike. Come to think of it, Pertwee's work in that story arc with UNIT often involves some sort of scientific hacking, trying to adapt the doctor's knowledge to help humans more directly, or to set to rights some other scientist-slash-hacker putting advanced alien technology to bad purposes. This may explain why I've always liked him just a bit more than Tom Baker, which is the doctor that I think most American viewers actually recognize more consistently. Though I also really like John Pertwee's mod style, to be honest, something that Dave Tennant shares a soft spot in my heart for much the same reason. He followed his curiosity first, which led him to mysteries to solve, people to help. Many of the Doctor's adventures even started implicitly on a whim. He or his companions had a desire to see a particular time or place. One could say he had a knack for finding trouble. I think it was more that he was aware enough to see what others overlooked, then had some internal ethic to set things to right. The Doctor knows the rules, but pierces them. He is clearly not bound by the rules of time and space. The TARDIS actually exists outside of both in the time vortex, if you're as much of a Doctor Who geek as I am, and I'm not even the geekiest Whovian there is. It was a colossal hack pulled off by the Doctor's native people, the Gallifreyans, specifically by Rassilon. He used a black hole to tweak the very laws of the universe to create this sort of loophole. Within the Time Lords, though, there were very strict rules despite this colossal bending of the universe to their will. Even with the ability to go to any point in time and space, the Doctor felt constraints, limits on his abilities to travel through time and interact with various events and people. More often than not, this was due to a certain immutability about time itself at certain key junctures. Dave Tennant's Doctor demonstrated that beautifully. His last companion, Donna, confronts him directly about it early on in Tennant's last season, the episode about Pompeii. In the standalone special, Waters of Mars, he explains it even much more fully. In that special, we get to see how hurt he is by these rules, staying his hand, having to let good people die, because time must unfold in a certain way for specific events. Tennant really sells that conflict through his performance, so much so that the Doctor ultimately ends up giving in as the last of the Time Lords. One could interpret what happens in the next special as a direct consequence of transgressing those very strict new rules. He ends up inviting chaos in the form of his recurring nemesis. Maybe not in the strictest cause and effect sense, but narratively, I think that idea hangs together. In the course of remaking the balance, he pays a very dear price, the ultimate one for him, regeneration. This isn't the first time the Doctor crosses the boundaries. It just happens to be the easiest to discuss since it happened so recently in the show's history. I actually recall a short story arc with Tom Baker where he briefly engaged with the Council of Time Lords. The ultimate price there wasn't quite as dear in the end, unless I'm completely forgetting. It's been some time since I saw that. But it had the same sort of flavor of kind of breaking the rules, playing with that ensuing chaos, then remaking the order after fixing that fundamental problem. In that case, actually revivifying and ossifying Gallifrey. You have to admit, the sonic screwdriver is really the ultimate hacker tool. Calling it a screwdriver actually belies its very multiple nature. It opens ways and seals things shut, like a traditional screwdriver taking out screws to open and tightening to close, but it could do so to anything that could be opened or shut, well, except for a deadlock seal. Even as a screwdriver, it bypassed the gross mechanics of that tool, directly wrought the intended effect. Opening and closing, though, is just part of its nature. The Doctor carried it much like a hacker might carry a multi-tool, or brandish a laptop loaded with all kinds of utilities. It was a sensing tool, part of how the Doctor explored the nature of things. A hacker equivalent might be a network stumbler or a port scanner. Seeing what is around to determine the cause of a problem, or find a weak seam through which access might be gained. Narratively, it was a small-scale Deus Ex Machina, a narrative cheat. I think it was effective, more so than the elaborate gadgetry of other shows. On Star Trek, we knew the writers were making babble up to drive the plot. With Doctor Who, the screwdriver distilled that down to its very essence. one little Spock spanner, let the story get on with it with far less distraction. Really, it was an extension of the Doctor himself, but making it an external gadget served a purpose. It served the story so that from time to time he could be deprived of this miraculous device, as in the very first episode where we see Smith in action as the latest Doctor. In that instance, we see that the tool is really defined by its user. A mere mortal could use the sonic screwdriver, but really wouldn't be able to do so to the best effect. They certainly would be unable to glean as much info with it. It can also alter the very nature of things, revealing a maker nature of the Doctor as well. In the sole season of Chris Eccleston's tenure, he used it to enable Rose's cell phone to dial across time and space. At times, it reinforced the point that the Doctor avoided using force. He didn't carry a gun, a blaster, or a laser sword. The screwdriver might be brandished like a sword, but never with intent to attack. At most as a defense, and then usually non-lethal. The Doctor's protean nature extends even to cheating death, a little bit, but in a hacker sort of way. This is a broken rule from our perspective, but not for a Time Lord. Regeneration carries a price, total change of the person and personality. In the newer seasons, not just Eccleston, there was also a period of adjustment following regeneration. The Gallifreyans, in unlocking the secret of regeneration, broke some rules, but settled down and found or wrote new ones. While regeneration may have been a trick used to keep the show running, it is in practice immortality. It makes sense of a character who hacks the laws of time and space to exist as outside of time and space as his carriage, the TARDIS. There is something that feels very hacked about regeneration as a means for immortality, though. If the time vortex with the black hole at its heart is essentially a limitless source of power, it stands to reason the original Time Lords could have come up with a more elegant solution, right? It implies that Rassilon, creator of the key technologies, was also a hacker, was perhaps more interested in what he could do than finding a necessarily neat or tidy way of doing so. The TARDIS, then, also, by extension, is a hack, and it really shows as it is temperamental and often breaks. The outward appearance of the Doctor's TARDIS is a long-standing bug, kind of a running joke that it always appears as a police call box no matter where it is. The TARDIS as designed is supposed to have a chameleon circuit that allows it to blend into its environment wherever it is in time and space. But the inside of the Doctor's TARDIS does go through periodic remodels, so some aspect of it also changes as the Doctor does. The later versions seem to have gotten more frenetic, almost like Rube Goldberg had a hand in designing them. And you get a sense that the Doctor is making up how to operate it by watching recent performers, but somehow their hacker nature, the Doctor's hacker nature, meshes with the hack of the TARDIS, and the whole thing just works. The Master, the long-standing nemesis, another Time Lord of Doctor Who, even hacks regeneration itself. Many fewer actors have portrayed the Master over his many incarnations. He transgresses the rule the Doctor operates by. Also, although this is a seems to be an odd sort of exception in looking at the Wikipedia entries talking about the companion Romana, that she's actually able to control her regeneration. That may have been more to do with the writers writing for comedic effect. I'll include a link to that kind of interesting section of the Wikipedia page on Doctor Who in the show notes, so you can see what I'm talking about. But it does hint that regeneration truly is a hackable system, that what the Master pulls off, he's found some sort of a loophole. The Doctor, by comparison, seems to really indulge in that randomness, maybe to welcome the chaos invited by what might be a fixable glitch. The Master demonstrates many of the costs, though, in controlling it too much. At one point, he's actually just a little bit better than a walking corpse. Throughout the many stories and adventures of the Doctor, the problems he encountered often were of his own making, and the consequences of his meddling. This is like a hacker inadvertently breaking a system. This reinforces his role as a rule bender and breaker. He usually enjoys fixing the problems he made, though it is a good opportunity to show both pathos and maybe some frustration with which hackers are often familiar during the course of their problem-solving activities. So despite things sometimes boomeranging back around on the Doctor, his enthusiasm for traveling and interfering rarely seems deterred. The best instances of the farther-ranging effects of his prodding at history are the little Easter eggs that the writers will work in. The best playing with causality, in my opinion, was the recent episode Blink, written by Stephen Moffat. What unfolded was not necessarily the Doctor's fault, though it was perhaps indirectly laid at his feet through his mistakes, but it really showed things going pear-shaped despite his efforts and did some interesting tricks with looping back and non-linear causality. As that particular episode unfolded, the Doctor was once again deprived of his normal tools. He had to sort of brute force the solution through time in a much more clumsy fashion, but one that ultimately worked well, with his sort of a message in a bottle to link the time in which he was trapped with the timeline we actually follow in the story. Many of the stories have this sort of counter-narrative. Trouble occurs even when the Doctor doesn't misstep. The Christmas episode with Eccleston was like that. He had been fooled by the aliens that he thought he was helping. These episodes stretch the Doctor's cleverness to its utmost, like a hacker going into deep hack mode. The result is sometimes nearly incomprehensible to those around him, but he manages to pull it out at the very last, working one of his very characteristic and recognizable miracles. I'm surprised it took me long to see Doctor Who in this light as a hacker. Many of the external trappings are superficially different, but on closer examination hold up well to this notion. Individually, each episode is gripping more for story or character or both. The grand scale of the hacking in the show, playing with time and space itself, may have also obscured the parallels for me. The biggest tell should have been clear much sooner, that the Doctor is defined so much by his sheer joy, whether he is simply exploring the cosmos or in the midst of peril attempting to save it. Once I have seen Doctor Who in this light, it changed my perspective on the show, especially compared to other science fiction that lacks a hacker as such a central figure. I look forward, actually, to new episodes and even going back and rewatching old ones with this new understanding to find more bits that fit into my theory and maybe even to expand my definition of what a space-time hacker would be like. I hope you enjoyed this notion of an unusual aspect of a science fictional character. If you have other examples of hackers in science fiction that maybe we might have overlooked, or thoughts even on the Doctor that I might have missed in my own consideration, as always, I'd be happy to hear them and in turn to share them with everybody else. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. I also hope that you enjoyed my use of the television show theme, or at least didn't mind it. I know that to this day, I still, every time I hear any version of that theme, get a little bit of a chill. If you want to help out with the show, the best thing you can do is tell a friend, or you can go to the website at thecommandline.net. You can click on the support link for all the different ways where you can help with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, you can call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show, which should go out in the feed Sunday night, will be a news program that is, of course, unless my duties for Mother's Day pull me away, hopefully I'll be able to accommodate. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Liberated Syndication and Wouta DeBee for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is made from 100% recycled bits. Permission to recycle those further, except where noted, is granted under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you can do what you like with the content as long as you tell folks where you got it and you share your changes under the same terms.